Welcome to The Security Detail, a podcast by Splunk Surge, where we examine the cyber threat landscape across different industries. I'm Audra Streetman.
And I'm Kirsty Payne. Today, we're taking a look at the energy sector, which encompasses the generation and transportation of electricity, oil, and natural gas. It's grown from coal combustion to include nuclear power, hydroelectricity, and renewables like solar farms, wind farms, and geothermal power. However, we already see rolling blackouts in some countries, and energy stability is a top strategic concern after geopolitical events have threatened energy security. Everything from sabotage to cyber attacks have made headlines in this sector. Securing the systems that underpin this critical infrastructure is a top priority, since the energy sector enables all other sectors.
And our interview guest, Joe Slowick, understands these cybersecurity challenges. He's tracked cyber threats to the energy sector in a number of roles, including threat hunter, intelligence professional, and detection engineer. And before we dive in, it's worth highlighting that just a day or two after we recorded this interview, Mandiant released a report about a disruptive cyber attack on Ukrainian critical infrastructure in late 2022, which they attributed to the Russia-linked Sandworm threat actor. And this attack reportedly used living off the land techniques in an operational technology environment to trip the victim's substation circuit breakers, causing a power outage.
What's interesting is that this outage coincided with mass missile strikes on critical infrastructure across Ukraine. And the incident also involved a second disruptive attack, where the threat actor deployed wiper malware in the victim's IT environment. So with that update in mind, let's dive into today's interview, starting off with how Joe ended up in his current role as threat intelligence manager at Huntress. Take a listen.
So I've been doing information security in one form or another for about 15 years now. I got my start in the US government, in the Navy, and then in Department of Energy, and moved on to Dragos for a bit. I've spent some time doing security research at Domain Tools, leading threat intelligence and detection engineering at Gigamon. And then I found myself at Huntress just at the start of this year to build a threat intelligence program for small and medium businesses, a underserved and underrepresented segment within the information security space.
And given your experience working at places like the Department of Energy, what would you say is the top cyber threat facing the energy sector today?
Top cyber threat is a combination of, are we going by impact or likelihood? So there's always like the meteor situation of someone manages to get access to a generating asset or to a significant number of transmission assets and disables service in a way that does not allow for it to be easily restored. That would be very bad. It's also really hard. The 2016 Ukraine event targeted one transmission and distribution substation and didn't quite work as effectively as it was designed to, at least in my analysis and in the analysis of others. But then on the other hand, you have ransomware on the IT networks of electric utilities and electric service providers. And while we haven't seen ransomware get into the control system networks of these sorts of entities, just taking out or inhibiting the function of IT assets can still be highly disruptive.
And one example I think of a ransomware attack on an IT network having much broader implications is Colonial Pipeline, where even though the OT network was not impacted, the company ended up halting pipeline operations as a result of that.
On the one hand, I would say Colonial Pipeline did the right thing in that they were uncertain as to the impacts and the reach of the breach in question and whether they still had good visibility into their operations and what was going on, thus leading to the cessation of transport ops. However, bad in that not figuring that out in advance and having that understood and understanding what those links might be really is not a good place to be. And as we start getting into things like the electric sector and beyond transportation, like pipelines and whatnot, there's an assumption that I think most people make that it's like, well, it's all OT anyway, just segment that. Or if you listen to certain uninformed opinions, just air gap it because make it inaccessible. It's like, well, it doesn't quite work that way anymore because there are links to IT assets and to external assets, whether it's because you have licensing servers that are operating in the industrial network that need to phone home to the vendor, or you have business process applications like your SAP instance or whatever that need to communicate items like fuel usage or other sorts of items so the accounting department can get it, and that resides in the IT environment. and not in your industrial network. So just thinking that you could isolate these things is unreasonable. It then becomes a question, can we preserve the functionality of core operational assets if we happen to lose or have a compromise in the IT environment? And I think when you look at regulatory environments like NERC-CIP and similar items, you know, we're seeing this with the NIST directives in the EU as well, that there's a growing understanding of what needs to happen from an administrative standpoint to better segment these items off and attain a better level of at least regulatory compliance with certain best practices. But these are all just paper exercises right now for the most part that haven't yet been tested very rigorously through an intrusion scenario.
And you mentioned how a lack of visibility can complicate incident response, for instance, with ransomware. So how do you think organizations can improve visibility? And would you say that most are struggling in that area?
I think most are struggling because we have, you know, over the last 10 years within IT environments, we've had a significant increase in visibility at the endpoint. We've seen multiple endpoint detection and response providers emerge, and then having the aggregation platforms, the SIEMs and so forth, like Splunk, that collect all that data and make it searchable and accessible. And that's all well and good. But then as we get into operational technology environments, we get into ecosystems where we're still dealing with legacy antivirus applications as being the front line of defense, even though that's largely aged off in almost all mature IT security environments in favor of EDR. And so we're left with a visibility proposition where endpoint isn't really that available outside of maybe operating system logs, and if you're lucky, application logs, but not the level of and depth of visibility that we would be used to in an IT environment. So as a result, what's been interesting is that we've seen a number of vendors emerge over the last 7 years in the OT space that have tried to leverage network visibility of identifying commands sent over the wire in the OT environment as a way of getting visibility into just what's going on with these systems and building that into detection and response suites. What's interesting, and I gave a talk on this a couple of years ago at the S4 conference in Miami, is there's a sense that having these protocols, these communications flow in the clear is a security risk in itself. But the fact that these communications are unencrypted and flowing in the clear right now is really providing the only significant source of visibility and monitoring available to an OT environment. So there's a tension when it comes to OT visibility, like within the electric sector or elsewhere, between do we harden certain communication pathways now as a way of getting ahead of potential threats, while at the same time denying ourselves significant visibility that can't be made up elsewhere? Or do we maintain fundamentally insecure communication protocols for the time being while we build towards a position where we get greater visibility at the endpoint or application level in the future? And this is really a question for the vendor ecosystem to figure out, how do we sort of balance this proposition between the inherent security of given systems and communications and visibility into them so that we have some awareness of what's going on?
I also want to ask you about malware that's specifically designed to target OT and industrial control systems, because from my understanding, there aren't many variants out there, right? Maybe 7 or 8, the last I heard. So why do you think that is? Is it because of the challenge of targeting OT networks, or maybe a higher prevalence of run-of-the-mill crimeware?
There's a few ways of looking at this. So on the one hand, if we go back to, say, the 2015 Ukraine power event, it was a nasty event and one that took a long time to recover from, even if service was restored fairly quickly. But there was no OT or ICS specific malware or software involved in making that attack happen. Instead, it was just a question of getting access to control systems and then allowing the adversary to interact with it manually. So there's this one part of the equation where it's like, well, if I could just get access to an engineering workstation, I can turn something off. I don't need malware to do that. So that's one element that, depending upon the level of ambition you have, that you don't need malware, or at least not OT-specific malware, to succeed in your objectives. The other side of this is that building malware for OT-specific functionality has a certain degree of specificity to it in terms of what you're targeting, how it's set up, what its functions are, and then what that exposes to you as a developer to interact with it. So even looking at the granddaddy of them all, Stuxnet, is a very specific piece of software in that not only was it designed to only execute in certain environments, but even that it was only designed to interact with a very specific set of Siemens Step 7 programmable logic controllers in the intended environments. So even though it spread to the point where researchers were able to discover it, it was only really effective in a very narrow set of situations. That's a really expensive proposition from a development standpoint to build something that really narrowly focused only on one thing. Then as we start moving forward to things like InDestroyer, Triton, and other items, we see a growing ambition on the part of developers in designing capabilities for these environments, but we also see them getting things wrong. InDestroyer is a really good example of that in that it was pretty ambitious in terms of what it was likely intended to do, but also failed technically on a number of levels. So this stuff isn't easy to perform either. And then as we get more towards the last couple of years, we've seen things like InController or Pipedream, depending on which vendor's reporting you're looking at, which provide a worrying extension in terms of capabilities in that we're seeing more of a framework targeting common platforms in industrial technology. So there's greater interoperability with different environments, but we don't know how that would have looked because it's never actually been spotted in the wild. So we don't really know what it was being used for. Within the past year, we've seen Crystal 2V as part of the Vulkan files, and then Cosmic Energy was identified by researchers at Mandiant. We also see software platforms that seem like they're almost more like testing and validation platforms for either measuring the security of operational environments or as ways of testing capabilities for how these work. So there's a really wide spectrum.
And there are a number of information sharing groups out there in the energy sector, like the Electricity ISAC, for instance, which partners with the Department of Energy to fund CRISP, which stands for the Cybersecurity Risk Information Sharing Program. Do you think that these types of groups are helpful, especially for small to mid-sized businesses, in order to stay on top of the threat landscape and collaborate with other organizations?
Yes. So looking at organizations like EISAC or CRISP can be exceptionally valuable, especially for organizations that are involved in critical segments of the economy, critical sectors of the country, but don't necessarily have the resources to have their own intelligence or vulnerability assessment teams, that these are vital resources to tapping that sort of expertise at a price point significantly less than signing up for a private intelligence service.
So the energy sector is a bit unique in that other sectors are dependent on energy to function. And energy is very much intertwined with the transportation sector, with pipelines, for instance. And with these dependencies comes third-party risk. So how do you recommend organizations in this sector defend against supply chain attacks?
And there's two different discussions within that question. The first is knock-on effects from critical supply links and critical infrastructure. If you don't have electric, you pretty much don't have anything, at least maybe not beyond a day or two if you have diesel generators on site. Even though we've only seen a handful of events that have actually impacted in a noticeable way the electric sector, why that remains a point of emphasis, because if that goes, all bets are off. You can't treat water, you can't run factories. That's why identifying those critical infrastructure key resource items when it comes to defense and resource allocation is very important, and why I get frustrated sometimes where we see the expansion of critical infrastructure to include things that are reasonably important, but not truly critical compared to some other items. The other aspect of this is no one is an island anymore. Everyone's relying on someone else for some capability. That's interesting because there's been worries in the OT ecosystem because so much of the manufacturing and development supply chain extends to places like China, which are not necessarily friendly, and what risk that poses for things like the supply of utility scale transformers or for circuit boards and so forth. The only thing I would caution, and while it's certainly a very real concern and something that I don't think has yet been, you know, even close to resolved, there's also a sense in my mind that the risks are maybe not overblown, but not quite completely understood because supply chain attacks aren't easy. I wrote a paper a couple of years ago about this that tried to delineate between you could either infect and enable a capability in all instances where something gets deployed, resulting in your being identified very quickly and just burning that entire ecosystem to the ground, which could be incredibly disruptive, but certainly doesn't allow for very narrowly targeted or well-crafted sorts of techniques and capabilities. Or you can have a very targeted approach to matters, like we saw in the SolarWinds example, which means you need some way of controlling whatever you've placed within the supply chain, of interacting with it, triggering it, or it controlling where it fires or takes place. And that's really hard. And it also means that there's a likely instance of there being some sort of communication involved with that supply chain compromise, which gives defenders an opportunity to identify that, hey, something's weird. Why is this asset trying to reach out to this infrastructure to do something? And I think that's where we need to go with the supply chain understanding, is that it's certainly a very real risk and it's a hard problem to solve, but also it's a hard problem for adversaries to adequately solve as well. And I don't think we've paid as much attention to that and what opportunities exist from a defense and monitoring standpoint to identify when a truly worrying supply chain capability is put out in the wild.
And that's a great point when you consider the steps that need to happen from initial access to actually carrying out a supply chain attack. So there are several opportunities to detect and prevent these attacks from being successful. And I also want to talk about another challenging aspect of cybersecurity, which is vulnerability prioritization. And I saw that you wrote a blog on this topic, so we'll link to that in the show notes. But this is definitely top of mind right now because we've seen so many critical vulnerabilities just emerging in the last several months. In vulnerability management, it's not as simple as looking at the CVSS score, right?
Yeah, I mean, the first step to any of this is really just having asset inventories. Do I even run this? And if I do, what version is it on? And a lot of organizations aren't doing very well on that front. And that's concerning on its own, because if you can't answer that question easily, all follow-on questions become significantly harder, because a vulnerability becomes a significant issue if it's externally exposed, there's a remote code execution component or capability associated with that vulnerability, and there is proof of concept code available for it somewhere. So there's in the wild exploitation. If those three items hold, patch immediately. And we're seeing this right now with the Atlassian Confluence vulnerability. We've seen it with WSFTP a few weeks ago. We've seen it with a number of things going back through hot zero-day summer. There's an important point to make that if we treat everything like an emergency, then nothing is an emergency. And I think these are the questions that we need to ask from a vulnerability assessment and patch management perspective, is start thinking through, okay, it's not just that there's a vulnerability and it has a certain CVSS score. It's also, what does this mean? What opportunities does this create for an adversary? And based upon those opportunities and how they align with the organization's risk appetite, to use that to drive the patching question.
And so the last question I have is, of course, about generative AI, because we can't do an interview in 2023 without talking about it. Have you seen any interesting use cases emerge in cybersecurity with large language models? And do you have any concerns about how they might be used for malicious purposes?
Yes, you can't have a discussion without talking about artificial intelligence these days. On the one hand, I think artificial intelligence applications, generative AI, large language models, etc., they're not there yet to be completely independent, and they probably won't be for quite some time, in my opinion. They are becoming more effective as assistants, working through scenarios, whether that's algorithm development for development work or identifying like fuzzing capabilities or fuzzing possibilities for vulnerability analysis, or even identifying edge cases for things like detection engineering. I would caution, though, that organizations that think that they can just like, oh, well, why do I need people anymore? I have the model that can do this for me. Just need to spend some time reading LLM-generated content and see that we still have a long way to go. There is a supervision aspect of things that is still quite important in order to get very reasonable and cogent solutions, which brings me to the malicious side of things. And it's an interesting question, because I look at AI as increasing the velocity of malicious activity. So speeding up the identification of vulnerabilities through automated fuzzing, speeding up the development of payloads that can target those vulnerabilities, or in developing variants of C2 platforms. But we're still talking about mathematical models at the end of the day. And if we're talking about models that are built based upon efficiency and with common seeding, we should anticipate that those models arrive at relatively converged solutions for similar problem sets.
Welcome to I'm the CISO and I Say So. This is where we ask interview guests what they would recommend or even mandate if they were a CISO of an organization in the industry they're speaking about. So we asked Joe what he would say if he was the CISO of an organization in the energy sector, and here's his answer.
know your vendors and know their responsiveness. A lot of what you do is dependent on and reliant on how your vendors are solving their problems. Knowing those relationships and what they imply for your organization will make your life significantly easier, whether it's a CISA data call for patch levels and certain vulnerabilities, or trying to fend off a ransomware intrusion or something along those lines. That self-knowledge aspect and knowing who you're dealing with is vital. And the earlier you can resolve it, the better off you are.
I really like Joe's insight into the difficulty of writing good OT-specific malware. It's not easy to target these systems, and the scope is usually limited. And I also really like Joe's pragmatic treatment of security problems, prioritizing realistic and immediate issues against the future perspectives, particularly around OT, when he said that communications in the clear is a security risk in itself. But the fact that these communications are unencrypted is really providing the only significant source of visibility and monitoring available in an OT environment. So it's a tricky balance between the here and now and preparing for the future, which I thought he addressed really well. What about for you, Audra?
Yeah, I also really like Joe's point about the challenges with OT visibility, which could present an opportunity for security vendors moving forward. And I also appreciated his take on third-party risk and supply chain attacks from an adversary's point of view and the challenges associated with carrying out these attacks, because they can be complex and difficult to pull off. And because of that, that gives opportunities to defenders through each step of the attack chain to prevent that from being successful.
So many interesting takeaways from that interview. And of course, we'll link to all of the resources mentioned in today's interviews in the show notes. You can also read more about Joe's interview in our ongoing blog series, which you can find at splunk.com/surge.
And that's all the time we have for this episode of The Security Detail. If you like what we're doing, please share The Security Detail with your friends. You can look for us on Podbean, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks for listening.